terms of the Biden administration's plans or response to what has happened?
So nothing new to report back from what Admiral John Kirby shared with all of you about an hour or so ago. What I will say, our deepest condolences go out, and our heartfelt condolences go out to the families who lost three folks who are military folks, who are brave, who are always fighting, who are fighting on behalf and of this administration, of the American people. Obviously, more importantly, we lost those souls, as the president said yesterday when he was in South Carolina. Our hearts go out to their families, to their friends. And let's not forget, there are wounded soldier military forces as well. And our hearts go out to them.
Well, there she is, KJP, with such deep, heartfelt sympathy for the fallen and their families. I mean, I just cried tears. And I'm sure Rob Carter, my guest this segment, who you hear every night from 8 to 10 here on, well, not on Saturdays and Sundays, but on weekdays, you hear him on News Talk STL. How you doing, Rob? I'm sure you cried crocodile tears, too, along with her when you heard that very heartfelt sympathy, didn't you?
You can understand with all of the applicants for the press secretary why she won. She's very, very eloquent. that clip was funny. I hadn't heard it yet, but that was was very interesting.
And I use that to, I think, really sort of display just how disimpassioned and how unserious I think this administration is about defending our country, defending our sensibilities, defending our very troops that defend us. And it's a sad time in America when you look at our foreign policy under Joe Biden, I think. How about you?
I feel the same way. I'm very cynical. You know, I talk about it all the time. I guess I was making fun of it last night, although it's not a laughing matter. But to think that we're going to war with our commander-in-chief being Joe Biden, who can't string a sentence together and nobody has any confidence in, nobody believes he really won the election with 81 million votes, but he's going to lead us into a war. Scary times, I don't know where the world is heading, but I just know that I don't want Joe Biden leading the way.
What do you think about the response thus far? I mean, it seems like they know exactly how many missiles they fired, 125, 85 targets. I mean, I don't recall previous retaliatory strikes describing in such detail what went on. And I'm going to ask this of Dakota Wood when we talk with him in the next segment. Do you think this is more for domestic consumption than for demonstrating our resolve to the enemy?
100%. I think it's, I always think it's orchestrated propaganda. I think that's what's happened when they moved the Smith-Mundt Act and rescinded it into the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act. That's when the CIA could begin to propagandize its own people. And I see a coordination between the military and the government and the media to sell whatever they want to sell. It's exactly what you said. The information that comes out seems very planned and organized. I don't know if you got to see Joe Biden talking to one of the service members who passed away. It looks so organized and so staged. And when you have a government that's under fire like this one, with wide open borders and inflation through the roof and no confidence, they like to start wars and change the subject and move all the corporate news channels to war. And we have to absorb it and try to figure out what's really going on. I'm one of the most cynical people when it comes to our own government. I just don't trust what's going on in there anymore. I've watched it long enough to recognize that something's not right. And any information coming from NBC News and ABC News and all these news channels, I take with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think we're all eating not a grain of salt, but one of those big pink Himalayan blocks of salt with a light under it. You know, I mean, it's the problem, Rob, and this is what troubles me more than anything. I'm afraid that there is a growing body of, there are a growing body of people in this country who, because of our educational system and the progressive movement that started in the early 1900s and really took off in the 60s and 70s, and who now lead educational so-called professional development classes in our and teach our teachers, that it's not a matter of, hey, we know how to do better. We're just doing the opposite because we want power. I actually think they think that this is the right way to do business, that you You embrace foreigners. Your bleeding heart leads to open borders and open jails. And if we just give people who need a reckoning with their behavior, if we just give them a little more monetary support, give them a cell phone, give them a bed, take it away from kids at the community center, take it away from school. I really believe they believe that this delusionary behavior is the right way to go. That's what's frightening. And more people look at the polls. It's about 50-50 this morning on the Real Clear Average polls. Trump leads Biden by 1% in Real Clear Politics. That can't be in a sane society, policy-wise. That's what
it makes you wonder. Yeah, it makes you wonder if it is all organized to be 50-50. If you look over the last 20 years since the World Trade Centers were bombed, everything's always 50-50. And if you were trying to hurt the country and if you were trying to manipulate elections, you'd always want the perception that everything is 50-50, because then you can do whatever you want. Whatever happens, happens, because nobody really has a sense of who's winning elections. Nobody has a sense of who's right or wrong. Everything is 50-50. And as it comes to the education system, you know, what's interesting to me, and just this is just purely observation, it seems like the most educated people in our society, and I mean with the big degrees and so forth, often can't see the forest for the trees. It really makes me nervous as to what's going on, because it feels like a generation, two generations, three generations are really being, they're almost sleepwalking as to what's going on in our own country, because you basically have an invasion across the southern border. And a lot of people aren't even paying attention to it. They just go on about their lives. If they can watch football on Sunday and they have food to eat, this is just like a movie that they watch on TV. They don't recognize that bad things are happening. And I always play the clip with Donald Trump. He says, I don't necessarily think these people are bad guys. I just think they're incompetent. And I think it's a combination of the two. I think people that organize the chessboard from a corporate standpoint, they like this invasion for whatever reason, whether it's cheap labor, whether it's to expand the social safety net so they can raise money for that, whatever the reason is, it seems something, it's either sinister or incompetent, and I believe it's a combination of both.
All right, well, and I think there is definitely some, talk about misinformation. They like to talk about misinformation coming from Russia about the election in 16 and again in 20, and misinformation about the virus, and misinformation about the vaccine and mask and blah, blah, blah. Well, listen to Jerome Powell gloating in the wake of the jobs report yesterday.
We've had just about 2 years now of unemployment under 4%. That hasn't happened in 50 years. So it's a good labor market. And we've seen inflation come down. We've talked about that. So we've got 6 months of good inflation data and an expectation that there's more to come. So this is a good situation. Let's be honest. This is a good economy.
Okay, so then I come across this report, Rob Carter, from Zero Hedge, that says under the surface, and this has been reported, but it's been muted, and I'm sure you're aware of it, the vast majority of jobs that have been created, A, are filling up, they're backfilling the loss caused by, the Republicans and the Democrats in 2020 with the virus, but they're part-time jobs. They get credited as jobs. And they're part-time jobs. And so one of the ways they're cooking the books, like, for instance, on wage growth, the number of hours, the Bureau of Labor Statistics use the average number of hours worked, and they take the pay divided by that, and they say, how much are you making per hour? Well, when the pay stays the same, but the number of hours go down, which it has in the recent reports, of course your wage growth appears normal. My point is, this appears to be smoke and mirrors in the reporting on the jobs numbers. Your thoughts?
I think it's exactly as you're describing. We're on the same page. It's data manipulation. You know, I was in business my entire career. I ran shoe businesses around the country, Skecher type of businesses. And when you're in the positions of power, you have people try to solicit you all the time. And they often use data manipulation, and you can see it right out in the open. Here's a perfect example of just data manipulation. And you don't have to go very far or ask many people to recognize the economy is not great. My daughter is 17 years old. She's a straight-A student. She's the most reliable person you'd ever want to know in your life. She was trying to get a job just at fast food grocery stores around the area, and it took her 4 weeks just to find a job. She must have filled out 50 applications. And I'm thinking, if you're I would think that any business would want a straight-A student who's reliable and is pounding the pavement trying to get a job. It should be easy, but it wasn't easy for her. It took her weeks, and I'm telling you, she must have probably 25 applications before she finally got work. That doesn't sound like an economy to me. I know when I was growing up in the 80s and I wanted to get a job at a fast food restaurant or a grocery store, I had my pick of 25 locations and they were all trying to hire me. And here we are in 2024 and a straight A student can't get a job at a fast food restaurant. So things are not cooking. And I think that's obvious. The inflation rates and the cost of energy and food is really crushing the middle class. But again, here's where the misinformation of the media comes out, tries to tell everybody how great everything is. And then if you hate Donald Trump, which a lot of people on the left just hate him for whatever reason, they don't like him, then they can start to talk about how great the economy is. And that conversation begins. And that's where this that's where the misinformation starts, is just pulling the wool over people's eyes who will buy anything. And then they begin a conversation amongst themselves. And it turns something that is obviously not true into certain people's realities. So I'm right with you. I think it's data manipulation. I think they're trying to, I think they use the media to fool the American people. And I think I think it works. That's what I think. I think it actually works.
There's a strange psychology going on because, you know, you look at the consumer confidence numbers, they're crazy, crazy high. You look at the personal debt on credit cards is at record levels, $1+ trillion. And yet people are saying roughly two-thirds of America says they're living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, none of this makes sense. And the only way you can figure it is that people are just in a short soundbite, social media driven world where people's attention span is now, you know, like a gnat's wing beating. I just don't know how they're believing, they're drinking the Kool-Aid. This is a bit of news making from Rob Carter, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go through that again, Rob. I'm hearing every time you walk into, you talk to any small business person, they tell you they can't get people to work. People sign, they apply, there's an interview, they don't show up for their first day, or they show up for one day and they leave. How does that square with your daughter's experience? Is this because she's not the right color, or she doesn't have blue hair with a nose ring, or she doesn't claim to be LGBTQA+! I mean, that doesn't make sense, Rob.
It's a combination of things. I thought about that last night, because she just got a job last night. So finally she got hired by Dairy Queen. So I let her do all of the work herself. I'm one of those, we let our kids do their thing and then we guide them through the process. She went out and filled applications and I said, well, where were you filling them out at? What were you doing? And she was really going for the big corporate jobs. You know, she was going for places that she knew. She was at Dairy Queen and she's at the corporate areas. I agree with you 100%, Randy. Almost my entire show is about the importance of small business. Small business, and if you don't know where they are, if you don't know who these small businesses are and you're not aware of them, as a young person generally isn't, they go to what they know. She knows Publix and she knows Schnucks and she knows the grocery stores, whether it be in, because we split time between Florida and St. Louis. So she knows the big chains, and it was harder to get a job there. Had she went to a small business, I agree with you, they would have hired her up in a minute. And that's what all my small businesses friends say as well. I got a buddy that has 75 employees, and the government made him select certain kind of employees within the last couple of years. And he said, Rob, he goes, the problem with hiring these people that the government wants you to hire, he goes, is they're unreliable. They don't show up. They'll show up for a week, and then, you know, I can't have people not show up for work. It destroys my business. But the biggest problem they have is just people sticking with the job and doing what they're supposed to do. And here you got somebody like my daughter, who is as reliable as can be, very bright, having a tough time getting a job in the corporate environment, which is very odd to me, but that's what happened. So it doesn't appear that within the bigger scheme of business that things are easy. It just seems like the economy to me is stagnant. It seems like people are having a tough time figuring out how to manage their lives, and that trickles down into the economy. It trickles down into jobs. So whatever the media is telling us about the statistics that they like to manipulate, you can just see it with your own eyes. You can kind of feel it, that things are not good, and I don't know how they're going to get any better with this administration, and especially with all of these workers coming into our society from the southern border. These people are going to have to work at some point, take care of themselves, which only creates a problem in the job industry. So nothing to me looks like it's on solid footing.
Well, if you get a chance, go down and say hi to Rob's daughter at Dairy Queen. Give her an attagirl. All right, Rob. Well, thank you for being with us, brother. Thanks for a little weekend time.
Love your show, Randy.
This is
a fan for a long time.
Thank you,
friend.
Thank you, sir. All right, we'll be talking. Take care. There he is, Rob Carter. You hear him every weeknight here from 8 to 10 on News Talk STL. We are News Talk STL, 101.9, 94.1. You hear the news that you know is true from the perspective of people living the life, not telling you how to live your life, not telling you how they think you should live your life. That's what's cool about it. We'll be back in just a minute when we talk to Dakota Wood and get the latest on what's going on over in the Middle East and the response to the fatal drone attack of last week.
Waking up to a brand new heart.
Randy Tobler, truth warrior, woke destroyer, on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter. This is News Talk STL.
To the families who lost three folks who are military folks who are brave.
Well, there's KJP in a moment of bewilderment trying to express sympathy for the loss of service members abroad, and now we've seen the response. Joining us to help unpack the insanity coming out of D.C. is Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Center for National Security at Heritage, and whom, by the way, was pivotal in the planning of the response to 9/11. He knows a little bit about responding to terror. Dakota, we're privileged to have you. Thank you, my friend.
Well, great to be with you on this Saturday morning. Thanks so much.
So I played that because it suggests the unseriousness of this administration, and maybe it was just a bumbling communications director who was not hired on merit but on identity. But I think it's a metaphor for what appears to the common bloke like me as an unserious approach to serious matters when it comes to foreign policy and our national security. The floor is yours.
Well, I mean, everybody has commented about the Biden administration being an extension of the Obama administration. So if we go back there as kind of the roots of the current policy, it's cozying up to people, right? Trying to essentially buy off other countries through economic incentives, by freeing up monies that were previously frozen, trying to incentivize Iran to not pursue a nuclear program by giving it all sorts of goodies. Now, how that's interpreted in that region is weakness, right? And the ability for it to be manipulated. And Iran has done what Iran has done for how many decades, since it seized power in the 70s. And so all these militia groups in the Middle East wreaking all kinds of havoc. All that is at the feet of the mullahs, the ayatollahs there in Tehran. So the Biden administration has kind of continued that approach. They don't want to get tarnished with, getting involved in another war. And yet the very policy decisions they make virtually guarantee that another war will occur because there have been no negative consequences on countries like Iran or Russia or North Korea or China. And so, the result of three dead Americans in Jordan is a logical and a natural consequence of those policy positions and implementation.
All right. Well, okay, you served decades as a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, and you were involved in operational matters and planning and logistics and so forth. So as I understand it, well, I know from my own involvement in medical care and hospital leadership that, we would do drills for natural disasters and how would we handle it when casualties came into the ER, and we would do, simulations. And then we would do an after-action analysis. That goes on in the military, right? Okay. Hear that they're now... So I think in Afghanistan, what happened there was we telegraphed when we were going to do what we were going to do. We bumbled it in doing it. Now we fast forward a couple of years and we telegraphed what we were going to do. Did they not learn from history, Dakota, or what?
No, it's wishful thinking. And I didn't hear the clip that you played earlier, so maybe my initial comment wasn't along the lines you're looking for. But yes, in terms of telegraphing moves, if you say we will respond, and you let a week go by, and then Iran makes known that they have withdrawn all of their senior IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders from that region. And then you launch an attack. It's at night to minimize personal, individual casualties. You're hitting various facilities. So there is a material cost, but the Iranians just rebuild, the computer, or they just, ship another missile into the region. There's no strategic end game here, right? So this telegraphing, this is what I'm going to do. You have a rough idea of when that's going to occur. You see a pattern of U.S. strikes that go against physical sites, a warehouse in the desert. And we're always saying we want to minimize personnel casualties, right? So there's no human cost to Iranian leadership, right? And clearly, we've only been doing this in Syria and Iraq, not against Iran itself. So there's a huge risk aversion aspect to Biden policy. There is an advanced warning aspect. And so if you were in the Middle East, how would you interpret that? Right. Again, no cost incentivizes additional aggression. You know that the Biden administration doesn't want to get involved in a war because it's all against the backdrop of the 2024 presidential election cycle. And so the White House is trying to walk this fine line by responding to public pressure that Americans, right, and 160 some odd attacks against U.S. forces just since October. And yet they don't want to be so aggressive that they start another war leading into the fall elections. So it's a logical consequence of this administration's approach to foreign policy that creates the very problems that presumably they want to avoid.
Talking with Dakota Wood, military analyst and security expert at the National Security Center at Heritage. Okay. So Lindsey Graham has come out and said, we need to hit their infrastructure. We need to take out their oil infrastructure. We need, and others have called. Tom Cotton, I think, has echoed similar sentiments. Is there an in-between, or is that what needs to be done? I mean, if you were the Secretary of Defense, sitting there with Blinken, Winken, Blinken, Nod, and Joe, and maybe the energy secretary, by the way, because we're fueling Iran's coffers by the energy policy, which increases the price of the oil they sell. What would you advise?
In dealing with crime in a city, undisciplined children in a family, any situation that is beginning to spiral out of control, mob violence going into stores and looting, ransacking shelves, these migrants coming across the border and going into shelters in New York City, attacking police and being released, without bond, and insulting all the Americans around them, right? So you can see a pattern of activities and lack of response that generate this larger problem. So in this, is there a middle ground between all-out war and doing nothing? Oftentimes there can be if you do it early enough. But when you let a problem get so severe, then the response to that has to be at the higher end. So going back to the Iranian issue, in the mind of Iran, if the costs are not severe enough to change behavior, then their behavior will not change. So deterrence only works. I mean, it only deters if in the mind of the person to be deterred, the consequences of their actions are going to be so bad that they decide not to act. So this whole idea of deterrence and conducting a counterstrike in response to these Iranian militia groups hitting Americans, if those counterstrikes aren't severe enough, then those groups are not deterred. And I hope that doesn't sound circular in its logic, right? That it gets us to a point where aggression in the Middle East has become so bad, like Hamas massacring 1,200 Israelis, that the counter response to that has to be severe. It has to impose punishment. And that has not occurred in any way with Iran specifically, not economically, not diplomatically, and certainly not kinetically through a military strike.
So you could see a multi-pronged approach if he had a cabinet that was allowed to think, and if he listened to them and was a true CEO that put together multi-tier response, as Lloyd Austin said, but not simply kinetic, but economic and diplomatic and other things. And I guess what you're saying is, it goes back to what you said earlier. Had there been a meaningful strike, maybe even the same targets, I ask, without announcement on Monday morning,
right,
and maybe take out a few leaders like Trump took out Soleimani, and suddenly they stood down. Iranians stood down for the rest of the Trump administration, right? I mean, because he took out the head of the snake.
Yeah, absolutely. To wait a week following, you know, after the attacks of Americans in Jordan there, it implies that we didn't know where things were at. So what has the administration been doing for 3 years? And all these militia groups running all over the place in Syria and West Bank and Gaza and Western Iraq, you know, et cetera, right? I mean, don't we know where these places are? Well, clearly we do. We have air assets in the region. You have carrier-based aircraft. You have ships with missiles. You have Air Force bases in Turkey and Qatar and Oman and elsewhere. And so you could be launching a strike at any time if you were postured to do that. So to wait a week, it could only have been because of political calculation. You know, what are the risks of doing X, Y, Z? And so if you're going to go after only 7 installations in that region and hit various buildings in those installations, which is how you get the target count up to 85, 125 weapons has reportedly been used, just isn't that much given our inventory, right? So this delay, the minimal size of the actual attack profile, doing it in the dead of night to minimize, you know, the human toll, actually killing Iranian-backed terrorists, right? It leads to this perception of hesitancy, risk aversion, an unwillingness to really protect American interests in the region, primarily American lives, but economic and diplomatic interests as well. And so, again, if you're Russia or China or Iran, you're going to view this as a hobbled, weak, uncertain Biden administration that is still going to be in office for, you know, nearly another year.
I saw one analyst in the break here before you came on, that said this was nothing more than a fireworks display in the desert, implying this is really for domestic consumption. And that is, I mean, that is a scathing, scathing indictment on Joe Biden's foreign and military policy.
Hamas attacks in Israel were in broad daylight, right? They had several hundred, if not into the few thousand, that went into these settler compounds, music festivals, and just absolutely massacred people. Horrific, but look at the message that sent, right? I mean, the impact that they had on the country of Israel. So for us to, you know, strike targets at 2 o'clock in the morning instead of in daylight, when you have activity going on, you've got military units moving around, people in chow halls, you know, those sorts of things. If you had acted immediately after the attacks on Americans in Jordan, you would have caught the Iranian commanders and their senior military people flat-footed in those regions. Instead, you give them a weekend to go back, you know, to their home country. And now what are you hitting? Well, it's just the foot soldiers and not even many of those, right? So in the Middle East, military power actually means something, getting smacked in the face really hard in kind of a crude way, actually means something. Economic, you know, sanctions, are you kidding me? Putting people on blacklists so they have to come across the U.S.-Mexico border instead of through New York LaGuardia. I mean, it's just all meaningless. And so this, you know, desert fireworks comment is probably pretty accurate in terms of how it's viewed in the region.
And I know it's not really a probably appropriate question to ask of a service member, a retired service member, a veteran. But is there any blame to be laid at the foot of either leadership there in the desert at that installation, Tower 22, or frontline people that confused an incoming American drone with the drone that ended up in the fatalities and the injuries? Is there something to be learned there? Is that just the reality of this kind of a situation?
it's kind of a reality. I mean, even when you're in a very dangerous situation, like either in Syria, where we've got about 850 Americans operating against Islamic State and other groups, or in supporting areas like Western Iraq or in Jordan that provide logistical support, fire support, those sorts of things, even there, you can't stay at 100% alertness all the time. It's physically, you know, impossible for mental acuity and, you know, physical stamina and those sorts of things. So you do have these periods where not a lot is going on, and you can get complacent. And then you add in whatever the rules of engagement are. You know, you can return fire if you are fired upon, as opposed to going out and looking for, you know, the bad guys. Do you have multiple signals coming in? Now, you would think that American unmanned drones would have IFF, you know, identification, friend or foe, you know, some kind of signal that's squawking that says I'm a good guy, as opposed to an Iranian drone, which wouldn't have those systems. So we don't know what happened that allowed that drone to get into that facility there, Tower 22. Certainly it was targeted appropriately to affect maximum damage, you know, in a house or a building where people were sleeping and all that stuff. And so it reminds folks that you have to be on maximum alert. And so that's just the reality. You know, my son is a young Marine in a Marine Corps Infantry Battalion, and they'll be deploying later this spring into that region. And so we're always talking about being serious in your training, you know, having fun while you're with your, you know, your squad mates and all that stuff. But you know, this kind of world doesn't forgive mistakes, right? And so it's something that the administration apparently doesn't realize. I'm sure that U.S. Central Command and the military commanders are going through the lists of what response options are, but they can't act unilaterally. They have to provide options to the administration, and then they say yes or no to whatever that option might be.
Yeah, what I heard there clearly was it's more of the risk-averse environment where we'd rather sacrifice Americans potentially and commit an error of omission in terms of being aggressive. When there's two drones coming in, it's like, maybe we take them both out, maybe whatever, you know, rather than, we don't want to make a mistake and look what happens, rather than, hey, we'll take the heat if we make a mistake. And then in one case, take out a civilian, if that's what it means. In the other case, take out our own drone, if that's what it means. Okay, I hear you. I got it clearly. Boy, man, this is rich stuff. Thank you, Dakota. Thanks for all your time and expertise. You're the best. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Dakota Wood, Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. When we come back, your thoughts on that conversation, and should that be a driving force issue-wise in the upcoming election? Let's talk about it. 314-912-1019 as we wrap it up here on the Tobler Show on a Saturday morning.
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer on News Talk STL. Talk lines are open now at 314-912-1019.
Good morning, everybody. Tony Colombo and Katie Fitzpatrick here.
Thanks for listening to the Randy Tobler Show here on News Talk STL. And don't forget to join us every weekday at 2 p.m. for Colombo and Katie.
Also, keep it here for my Saturday morning show, the Bluff City Outdoor Show, today at 11. Now, back to Dr. Randy Tobler. Love you, Doc.
Love you, too, Katie and Tony. And boy, I love that show. Love to be on with them every Thursday afternoon. Good to be back on. I do a little bit with Tim and Chris on Tuesday afternoons as well. It's a big happy family here on News Talk STL. Glad you're a part of the family. Feels good, doesn't it? As we head into a very pivotal election season, the current polls suggesting maybe things are a little tighter with Biden versus Trump. Trump still a little bit ahead in most polls. Real Clear Politics average is about 1.8% by for Trump. A little better if you look at some of the breakouts in the various states. Georgia, Trump is doing well. Others are a little closer. You throw a third party into the mix, and he doesn't do as well. By the same token, Nikki Haley does very, very well versus Biden on a head-to-head, better than with Trump versus Biden head-to-head, at least in the Quinnipiac poll, which doesn't do well for Biden at all, or for Trump at all. I think it's going to hinge. I think this election may hinge less on Trump and Biden than it does on Donald Trump, assuming he is the nominee. It's pretty clear he will be. And if you look at foreign policy alone, he should be in the Oval Office like today. No, make that Sunday when this happened. No, make that October 8th. I mean, none of this carnage in the Red Sea with the Houthis. I don't believe any of this would have happened if Donald Trump would have been in office, because they know that he's unpredictable, which sometimes a bad thing for him, but mostly a good thing. When it comes to foreign policy, it's a great thing. He's unpredictable. He acts swiftly and quickly and severely and gets the heck out of there, like he did in Syria. Remember, he would have sent in strikes in Syria. That kind of an activity and that kind of a kinetic mindset is a great, great thing in this world, as Dakota Wood said, is just absolutely, these people are unhinged in the Middle East. They're absolutely, they only know power, violence, and really nothing else, right? The exertion of it. They don't really, diplomacy is really a second or tertiary way of doing business in their mind. So, and Trump recognizes that. So from a policy, a foreign policy perspective, that's important. But as it relates to the election, there are other issues on people's minds, right? For the blue side, it's climate change and abortion. For the red side, yeah, foreign policy, borders, and economy, yes. But it seems as though the center right part of the electorate, I don't think that many of you nor I think that this economy is in great shape. We talked about it earlier with Rob Carter. And if you didn't get a chance to hear it, Jerome will have the podcast up later today, right?
Oh, yeah. Just give me until around noon and I'll have all of that for you.
We talked about it. I mean, the Zero Hedge report on the economy and on the jobs numbers shows how they've been cooking the books. The BLS is cooking the books to make it look very, very good. All the jobs are created. A lot of part-time jobs. And on an hourly basis, you generally pay more for a part-time worker than you do a full-time worker. So, of course, wages appear to be going up. Why is consumer debt going up? Why are the percentage of Americans living paycheck to paycheck going up? Something is fundamentally wrong in the core foundational aspects of our economy. Not the macro numbers, but the numbers you and I live every day. I continue to be astounded. There's a new Japanese place down the street that opened up that I wanted to try out some of their hibachi thing, you know, a little tuna, a little seaweed, a little cucumber, I don't like the rice. I said, leave out the rice, please. They just opened up 6 months ago. I wanted to help them out. Great, 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 great food. $8.50 for it was nice. It was good. I'm not complaining, but you know, 2 years ago, that would have maybe been $5.50, $6.50, maybe $7. I don't know. You go to the store, you try to buy a bag of goods, it's ridiculous. So we're feeling it. They're transmitting another thing. I fear that without the right, and I'm not sure what the right, but the right vice presidential candidate for Donald Trump is, that I think that abortion issue is so strong, it might outweigh an economy that by cooking the books and owning the media that a lot of people listen to, NPR and others, that might dwarf in the minds of the independent voters who will make the difference. I'm just afraid that abortion issue may just dwarf the others. And if Joe gets enough of a wartime president without starting a war, but being involved in defending America, because, you know, if you saw that old movie, Wag the Dog, where they started a war to sort of create that wartime president, I don't know. We got to have a vice presidential. What are the components of the right vice presidential nominee for Trump to pick? I think someone may be a little more moderated and measured in their communication. I don't think we need another Trump Jr. I think Ramaswamy would be a huge mistake. I think someone like a Marjorie Taylor Greene, maybe even a Carrie Lake, would be a huge mistake. It's got to be someone that can appeal to that center right, who is capable of voting for a Trump on the issues, even though they don't like his character, and can maybe see a future 8 years of similar policies, different communication style. I think that's the secret sauce. Jerome, what do you think? Think that's important or not?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that a lot of people don't really consider how important a strong and effective and supportive vice president is. You know, everybody just thinks of the president themselves. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at it.
Yeah. I mean, and we've got such a feckless, weak pair in the Oval Office now between Joe Biden, who all he can remember is what kind of ice cream he eats, to Kamala Harris, who can't string a bunch of words together without it looking like your favorite salad at your local eatery. I mean, it's word salad every time she speaks. But she's been on she's already beaten that drum of abortion, abortion, abortion. That is going to be a powerful issue. And we cannot bully our way. Those of us who are pro-life can't say, we can't demean those people. We can't demonize them. We can't say you're immoral jerks and killers, baby killers. That's not going to win the day with the voters. It's not going to do it. I'm sorry. That's just the reality. Got to find a way to do better. All right, that'll wrap it up for this edition of the Tobler Show. We'll look forward to that vote on the Mayorkas impeachment, more retaliation against the lethal drone attacks, and other unpredictable goings on. See you next week. Thanks for being here.